if you would, to Nehemiah chapter 2. Nehemiah chapter 2, and put your ribbon or a piece of paper, something in Nehemiah chapter 2, and then turn to 1 Samuel chapter 13. 1 Samuel chapter 13. We're going to actually start in 1 Samuel 13, and we'll be in Nehemiah chapter 2 in a minute. This week, many of you know that Melanie and I attended a pastor's conference / retreat thing down in Southern California. And during one of the sessions, the speaker said something that caught my attention. I had never really, it just never really took root in my heart before. But when he said it, I started scribbling notes and different things. And so I want to kind of share a little bit, because it goes perfectly, I think it goes perfectly along with the passage in Nehemiah. But in 1 Samuel chapter 13, this is the verse that struck me. In verse 22, 1 Samuel chapter 13, in verse 22, "And it came to pass in the day of battle that there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people that were with Saul and Jonathan, but with Saul and with Jonathan his son was there found." In other words, the only two people in the nation of Israel that possessed a sword was the king, Saul, and his son, Jonathan. And the setting here is very unique. It's not unique, but it's different. Israel had become dominated by the Philistines. The Philistines had foundries, and they had the ability to work iron and to make chariots and weapons of war, swords and spears and all of that. And it got to the point that Israel was so dominated by the Philistines, if they even wanted to sharpen their plows, they would have to pay the Philistines to do that. So they had nothing. They had no way of fighting. And here they are in chapter 13. They're standing ready to go to battle against the Philistines. And nobody has any weapons except David and Jonathan. The Philistines had 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen or cavalry personnel, and the foot soldiers were as the sands of the sea. So here the Philistine army is getting ready to go to battle against Israel. Can you imagine what that would look like in your eyes? Here you put yourself in the position of the soldier on the Israeli soldier, and here you are. You're standing against an opponent that has 30,000 chariots, and we've got none. They've got 6,000 cavalry, and we don't have any. And the foot soldiers are as the sand of the, they can't even count them, there's so many. And we're in big trouble. Isn't that how most of us would look at it, right? I'm just being honest. Most of us would look at it that way. First Samuel. Well, as Melanie and I were at this conference, and the you know how, I don't know if you're like me. I hope you're not, because my brain doesn't work normal. But when I hear something like that, my brain usually starts taking side roads, and I really didn't hear a whole lot about what the speaker said after that. I just remember thinking, man, that is incredible. But then my brain kind of came back to the message and what he was talking about. And in 1 Samuel chapter 14, let's read in verses 1 and 2. And it came to pass upon a day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said unto the younger man that bare his armor, come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison that is on the other side. But he told not his father. Verse 2, and Saul tarried in the uttermost part of Gilgal under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron, and the people that were with him were about 600 men. So here you have 600 soldiers, and they're all hiding with Saul. Saul is hiding under a pomegranate tree. And here we see two men, Jonathan and Saul. They are both facing the exact same situation. They are both armed with the same weapons. They both own swords. They are both facing the exact same enemy. But we see two completely different responses. Saul goes into hiding. Finds himself a nice shade tree and he camps under the shade tree. And he looks around at his circumstances and he says, man, I am like beyond outnumbered. It is not even close. The people that are with me are scared and running away. Turn back to chapter 13 for just a moment and verse 5. And it says, and the Philistines gathered themselves together to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots and 600 horsemen. Oh, I said 6,000. I'm sorry, 600 horsemen. It is 6,000. Anyway, just ignore me. Just read. And the people, as the sand of the sea, which is on the seashore in multitude, and they came up and pitched in Michmash eastward from Beth-Aven. And when the men of Israel saw, they were in a strait, for the people were distressed. Then the people did hide themselves in caves and in thickets and in rocks and in the high places and in pits. And some of the Hebrews went over Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. As for Saul, he was yet in Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. And they tarried 7 days according to the set time that Samuel had appointed. But Samuel came not to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. So not only were they outnumbered to begin with, but the people are looking and they're saying, there is absolutely no way. And what are they doing? They're scared. They're hiding. They're leaving the battlefield. And Saul is freaking out and he's like, what am I going to do? Not only am I outnumbered, but I'm outgunned, so to speak. I have nothing to fight with. I've got two swords in the entire country. Nothing can be done. Everything and everybody is against me. Have you ever felt like that? Yes. I have. Absolutely, I have. But then you have Jonathan. What his father saw as a deficit, Jonathan saw as an advantage. Here you have Jonathan facing the exact same problems, the exact same situation, the exact same enemy, but you have a completely different perspective. Oh, I just gave away my magic word. I wasn't supposed to say that word. The question then becomes this. How can two men facing the exact same resources, the exact same problems, everything, come up with two completely different responses? Now, let me ask you a question. Have you ever known somebody who is facing a physical challenge of some sort, be it a medical, a relational issue, and so on and so forth, and they come out of this thing saying, hey, God's in control? But have you also known people who have gone through similar, if not the exact same thing, and they walk around going, oh, woe is me. We all know those people, do we not? What is the difference? The difference is perspective. The perspective of people. And in this case, it is the perspective of God's power and love. One believes that God can do anything, and the other believes that God can do nothing. And as we approach the message this morning, I want to ask you, which one are you? And this is not about an optimist and a pessimist. That has got nothing to do with it. It has everything to do about your trust in God. First Samuel chapter 14, verse 6. And Jonathan said to the younger man that bare his armor, come and let us go, excuse me, over unto the garrison of these uncircumcised, and it may be that the Lord will work for us, for there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few. And his armor bearer said unto him, do all that is in thine heart. Turn thee, behold, I am with thee according to all thy heart. And Jonathan, then said Jonathan, behold, we will pass over unto these men, and we will discover ourselves unto them, or basically make ourselves known unto them. If they say unto us, tarry until we come to you, then we will still stand still in our place and will not go up unto them. But if they say unto us, come up unto us, then we will go up, for the Lord hath delivered them into our hand, and this shall be a sign unto us. And both of them discovered themselves unto the garrison and the Philistines, and the Philistines said, behold, the Hebrews come forth out of their holes where they had hid themselves. And the men of the garrison answered Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us, and we will show you a thing. And Jonathan said unto his armor bearer, come up after me, for the Lord hath delivered them into the hand of Israel. And Jonathan climbed up upon his hands and upon his feet, and his armor bearer after him, and they fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer slew after him. And the first slaughter, did you get that? The first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men, wherein, as it were, a half acre of land which a yoke of oxen might plow. Here you have a story of a man who was faced with the impossible. One sword. In fact, the armor bearer that was with him, I can see it now. Okay, Jonathan, you kill someone so I can get his sword, so I can help you. And then his armor bearer, he and his armor bearer, on their hands and knees, climbed the mountain to get to the enemy. Now, question. I want you to think about this. We just read the account. Did Jonathan, what was Jonathan's perspective of God's power? Did he look at his armor bearer and say, "Hey, buddy, we got this. Our God is strong and mighty. We got this." Is that what he said? No. Let's go back and read it, because I was just absolutely blown away with this. Look at verse 6. "And Jonathan said to the young man that bare his armor, 'Come, let us go unto the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work with us, work for us.'" What's he telling his armor bearer? "Hey, buddy, we might die. God might do this." That just blew me away. Can you imagine the perspective of this, of Jonathan as he tells his armor bearer, "Hey, let's go do something really stupid because we might survive." The next phrase that he uses here, and it says, "And it may be that the Lord will work for us, for there is no restraint to the Lord." In other words, God is not restricted by anything human.
Amen.
It might be that God is, it just might be that he's going to take care of this because he is able. He may or may not, but he is able to do the impossible. And then he says one more thing in verse 6. "For there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many," or by what?
"Few."
God doesn't need an army to do the impossible. Those of you that are familiar with the story of Gideon, what did God tell Gideon? "Hey, you got too many. You need to whittle this thing down." And then he comes back and he says, "No, more need to go." And he got it down to 300 men. And God showed himself strong. See, God could do it with one, or he could do it with 100 million. It doesn't matter. You know, I was thinking this week that, I don't even know why this has popped into my head. Anyway, free commercial here. You know, we own 10 acres out on Farm District Road. And I would love one day to build a church out there. And we look at this and at this pastor's conference I was talking to somebody, I don't remember now who it was, but I was telling them that we own this property. And I made the comment, I said, "But it's crazy how much money it's going to cost us to develop this property." And I explained about the, you know, Farm District being a state highway and they're going to require. And I said, and I made the statement, I said, "We're talking about $1 million to $2 million just in road improvements before they'll even talk to us about a permit." And everybody at the table was like, "Oh, wow. Woo, woo, woo." You know what dawned on me? Which is harder for God, to give us $5 million or $5? Which is harder for God?
Neither.
See, we serve a God that, what's it say here? In verse 6, "For there is no restraint of the Lord to save by many or few." When God's ready for us to build, guess what? We'll build. Until then, we need unit 111. I had to throw that in. I'm sorry. As I was reading through this and my mind was going 100 miles an hour, my thought went to something that would happen just a few years later from this event. And that is David, before he became king. David's perspective of God's power and love was demonstrated many, many times, but one very elaborate time when he faced Goliath. David and Goliath, a very popular story amongst the people who know the Bible. I love this story. But in 1 Samuel chapter 17, verses 43 to 46, it says this, "And the Philistine said unto David, Am I a dog that thou comest to me with a stave? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said unto David, Come unto me, and I will give thy flesh unto the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field. Then said David unto to the Philistine, How comest to me with a thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to you, or to thee, in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defiled. This day will the Lord deliver thee into mine hand, and I will smite thee, and take thine head from off thee, and will give the carcass of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air, and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel." And as I thought about the situation with Jonathan and Saul, and I thought about David, and I thought, how could David be so confident to stand against a giant of a man and stick his finger in his face and say the things that he said? How could David be so confident in that? And then my mind went back to 1 Samuel chapter 17 and verse 37. "And David said, Moreover, the Lord hath delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear. He will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said unto David, Go, and the Lord be with thee." David had already experienced the saving power of God in his life. His perspective was that God could do anything through him. And too often we get so consumed with the circumstances like Saul, and the fact that he was outnumbered, and the fact that he could see no solution to the problem, he allowed the circumstances of life to control him instead of the taking control and allowing God to control the circumstances. We see the same perspective in Daniel chapter 3, verses 16 to 18, when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego stood before the king. It says, "And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. For if it be so, our God we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thy hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods nor worship thy golden image which thou hast set up." I love Shadrach and Meshach. They look at the king and they say, you know what, our God is able. Well, whether he's going to do it or not, we don't know. But he's able. And that's exactly the same thing that Jonathan told his armor bearer. I don't know if God's going to save us, but he's able, so let's go do it. God is able if he chooses not to save us. There are going to be times in our lives where we're going to face difficulties. We're going to know, hey, God is able to take care of this situation in my life. But you know what? Sometimes he's just not going to, and we're going to have to deal with it. Is God able to do anything that he chooses? The answer is?
Yes.
Absolutely. Jonathan saw the same impossible situation as his dad, but he chose to trust God instead of being fearful of the circumstances. Martin Luther wrote this, faith is living, faith is a living, daring confidence in God's grace. It is so sure and certain that a man could stake his life on it 1,000 times. That's faith. Look at 1 Samuel chapter 14 and verse 23. Let me encourage you to go back and read this entire story. It's an incredible story what God does. But look at verse 23. It says, "So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle passed over into Bethaven." God saved Israel that day. Completely outnumbered, outweaponed, everything. All because of the faith of one man. One man made the difference. Saul filtered his perspective of the situation through the lens of personal ability. Jonathan filtered the situation, or his perspective, if you would, through the lens of faith. He saw the same impossible situation, and yet he decided to trust God. Way too often, we filter our lives through the filter of personal ability. I'm guilty of that. I do it all the time. But it's wrong. If we are going to be people of faith, it is going to be because we put our faith and trust in God's ability and love for our lives. John chapter 15, verses 4 and 5, "Abide in me and I in you, as the branches cannot bear fruit of itself except it abide in the vine. No more can ye abide in, except ye abide in me. I am the vine, ye are the branches. He that abideth in me and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit. For without me you can do nothing." The understood truth here is with him you can do anything. That's the understood truth. Missions Month, as we are in the midst of, is really about perspective. You say, "Pastor, I can't afford to give any more money to missions." What's your perspective? Are you filtering that through faith, or are you filtering that through your bank account? I'm not begging for money. That's not the point. My point is, what are you trusting in? Are you trusting in God, or are you trusting in your bank account? "But Pastor, I don't know. God is doing something in my heart and life, maybe to be a missionary, maybe not. I don't know, but I'm scared about it." Oh, really? What are you filtering your life through? Are you filtering your life through faith, or your circumstances, your fears? See, missions is a subject that scares a lot of people. I know people who have had young children that have surrendered to go to the mission field, and they have done everything they could to discourage their children from doing that because, You know, well, they may end up in Africa. Well, praise God for that. I would rather be in Africa in the middle of God's will than be in America out of God's will. C.H. Spurgeon once said, I feel that if I could live 1,000 lives, I would like to live them all for Christ. And even then, I would feel that they were all too little a return for His great love for me. As we look at the book of Nehemiah and we take what I have given you out of 1 Samuel, it's almost like two sermons in one here, kind of, but not really. Because I believe what I just gave you out of 1 Samuel is exactly how the way Nehemiah lived his life. He lived his life with a perspective and filtering his life through faith. The perspective of God's love and power in his life. The title of my message this morning is this. All that was introduction, and I'm almost done. He was a man of faith. He was a man of faith. Talking about Nehemiah. He was a man of faith. Nehemiah chapter 2. Let me turn there. I got my ribbon there. Nehemiah chapter 2 and verse 1. And it came to pass in the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of Artaxerxes the king, that wine was before him. And I took up the wine and gave it unto the king. Now I have not been before sad in his presence. Nehemiah makes an incredible statement here in chapter 2 and verse 1. An incredible statement, and that is this. I had never been sad in the presence of the king before this day. The statement here is an important statement because of this. Anyone who came before the king in a bad mood or even sad could be banished or killed on the spot. Because the monarchs of this time, they wanted nothing sad to be around them, which is kind of foolish when you think about it, but that's the way it was. And this statement that Nehemiah makes here in chapter 2 and verse 1 is it is an incredibly important statement to the context of the rest of the chapter. Nehemiah would have easily been taken out and his head cut off because he was sad before the king, or his countenance was sad. Can you imagine having a job where you have to be happy all the time? Some of us could do it. Some of us, yeah, no way. I want to look at three characteristics. Hey, Chris, just information. I'm skipping a couple of verses here. We're going to look at three characteristics over the next couple of weeks about Nehemiah. The first one is that he was patient. We're going to look at his patience this morning, and then we'll be done. He was patient. Verse 2, wherefore the king said unto me, why is thy countenance sad, seeing thou art not sick? This is nothing else but sorrow of heart. Then I was very sore afraid. Again, an important statement. I was very sore afraid. In other words, he was scared to death. Because he knew that all the king had to do was stab his fingers and he'd be dead. He was scared to death. Verse 3. And I said unto the king, let the king live forever. Why should not my countenance be sad when the city, the place of my father's sepulchres, layeth waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire. The time period between Nehemiah chapter 1 and Nehemiah chapter 2 is roughly about 4 months. And Nehemiah patiently waited on God to work in the hearts, in the heart of the king, because he knew he was going to go before the king one day and ask the king's permission to leave. Hebrews chapter 12, chapter 6, verse 12. That ye be not slothful, but followers of them who through faith and patience inherit the promise. Patience. Patience. Warren Wiersbe wrote this: we must know not only how to weep and pray, but how to wait and pray. I don't like that. I'm just saying. How many of you with me on that one? How many of you like to wait on God? I want it, and I want it what? Now.
I learned the first time.
Yeah. Exodus chapter 14, verse 13, and Moses said unto the people, fear ye not, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will show you today. And the Egyptians in whom ye have seen today, ye shall see them again no more forever. Psalm chapter 46 and verse 10, be still and know that I am God. And I will be exalted among the heathen. I will be exalted in the earth. We need to be patient. If you were to come to my house and go upstairs to my office and sit in my chair, my office chair, if you look straight across on the wall, right in front of me, I have this quote on this wall, and I have it there for a reason. Hudson Taylor said this: it is not lost time to wait upon God. And I put it there because I am one of the most impatient people on the face of this earth. And I have to have a constant reminder that it is important that I wait on God and His timing in my life. Patience. Patience is important in our lives. Patience in reality is really, let's see, how do I want to put this? The reality about patience is our perspective of God's power and love for us. Does that make sense? It does to me anyway. Saul did not understand God's power and love, and he ended up hiding and running, and the people ran away because they were fearful. But Jonathan's perspective was completely different, and he was able to attack the enemy and do the impossible. David was able to stand toe-to-toe with a giant and defeat him, and we hopefully... many of us know the story. A sling with a rock took out a giant. The impossible. Nehemiah would stand before the king and ask the king to do the impossible. There's an important truth here, and this is it. Part of our anxiety or our unbelief comes from our inability to understand how God is working behind the scenes. We can trust and say, okay, I know God is working behind the scenes because He has done it for me in the past. But the fact that we can't see it is a problem for us, right? Why? Because most of us struggle when we can't see or touch it. We can say, I know God is doing this. Can you imagine Nehemiah standing before the king that day, and his countenance was sad? And the king says, why are you sad? You're not sick. And Nehemiah, in his own words, says, I was scared to death. Can you imagine what was going through his mind in that split second? Okay, I'm done. Or was he thinking, God, I need your help? I don't know what he was thinking. He could have been thinking this in Psalm chapter 21 and verse 1. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. As the rivers of water, he turneth it whithersoever he will. Now, obviously, Psalm was written after this Nehemiah. But the point is, he still understood the same truth, that God is able to steer the heart of the king. Can you imagine you standing there like Nehemiah in front of the king and him saying, hey, why are you sad? And your heart dropping into your feet, being scared to death. What would your thought be? What would your thought be? We don't know what he thought, but we know he trusted. Patience. The reality of our patience is our perspective of God's love for us and his power in our lives. How are you going to react when problems come into your life? Because problems are part of life. How are you going to react? You going to react like Jonathan? Or are you going to react like Saul? Let's pray. Dear Lord, thank you for this day. Thank you for your love and for the work you do in our lives. And Lord, thank you for the Word of God and the power of the Word of God that can change lives. And Lord, I do ask that you would be with us this morning, that you would challenge us in our thinking, and that you would help us to see and to know just how much you do love us and how powerful you are in our lives. I am so thankful for that. Help us, dear God, to serve you with every fiber in our being. Lord, help us to understand our perspective and get a good and right perspective. Thank you for your love and for the work you do in our lives. With every head bowed and every eye closed, let me ask you, is there anyone who say, Pastor, God has spoken to my heart?